Hi, first I'd like to thank you all for inviting me to talk about some work I've been doing with my thesis advisor, Kent Irwin, as well as our theorist collaborator, Peter Graham, on sort of just understanding, if we're looking for axion and hidden photon dark matter coupling to photons, how well can we possibly do subject to certain constraints on our experiments? So here's an outline of my talk. I will very, very briefly talk about axion and hidden photon dark matter. The people in this audience know much more about this than I do. I'll just basically give you the things that we need to know in order to start setting these limits. Most of this talk will be focused on understanding what these limits are. Pretty much everything I'm going to talk about in this respect can be found in this paper. Those of you who have seen this paper know that this setting these fundamental limits is a very broad topic when it comes to the standard quantum limit. So I will condense 160 pages into 30 slides. And really what this will involve is it's one part dark matter properties and one part fundamental electrical engineering statements having to do with circuit models and quantum noise. So I will mention inductors, resistors, capacitors, those sorts of things. And then I will talk about our experiment at Stanford, DM Radio, and show how these fundamental limits can be used to inform practical searches, and end with a little blurb about future prospects for ultralight dark matter searches, specifically going beyond the standard quantum limit on amplification. So as I mentioned, we are looking for the axion and hidden photon coupling to photons in our dark matter searches. These are both very well motivated bosonic candidates for light field dark matter. For the axion, you need a background electromagnetic field to get the axion to photon conversion. It's usually a DC magnetic field. And in each case, you're looking for a photon that is just relating to the mass frequency by HF equals MC squared. It's not a monochromatic signal, but has a 10⁻⁶ bandwidths set by the dark matter virial velocity. And the key to remember here that we will be using for detection is that since these are very light, sub EV, we can treat them ultra high number density and look for classical coherent oscillations in the form of an electromagnetic field. So our motivation for doing this is, well, there's a lot of parameter space in mass and coupling that hasn't been explored. Really, when it comes to, say, probing QCD couplings, it's been ADMX so far. And similarly for the hidden photon, there's lots of low-hanging fruit that we can go after. And accordingly, since there's lots of unexplored parameter space, there's many, many search techniques. So you can talk about resonant ideas. So you've got classic cavity haloscope experiments like ADMX and Haystack. You've also got the axion LC search at Florida, DM Radio, which I'm going to talk about. But you don't necessarily need to do resonators. You can do reactive searches, broadband searches like Abracadabra. You can think about using free space antennas like BRASS. But among all these, let's just ask, okay, fundamentally, what technique is best? And to do this, we need to figure out, okay, how do we make apples to apples comparisons? We need to be able to set our detectors to have the same volume, the same loss, even the same priors informing the search ranges, which is one thing that I'll talk about. And once we've done this, say that what are the limitations on the sensitivity of any technique? And naturally, this is a very broad question, and we need a unified framework for modeling electromagnetic receivers. Luckily, we have one, and that is exactly what a circuit model is. One can say, well, in the same way that, well, that I might try to characterize normal electromagnetic signals, say waves in vacuum with circuit models, I can think about characterizing coupling to dark matter fields, electromagnetic fields with circuit models. And that's pretty much the premise of how we set these fundamental limits. So before I even draw a circuit model, let me give you a schematic. And this schematic will pretty much guide our discussion. The schematic breaks down into three parts. The first is the signal source. What I mean by this is that there is an element in my circuit that couples to the dark matter field. Could be an inductor coupling to the magnetic field introduced by the axion hidden photon. It could be a capacitor coupling to the electric field. Then I have a matching network. And for right now, you can just think of this as all the other elements.
But there is a question about what the dark matter signal is. Is it a current? Is it a voltage?
I'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right now, I'm being very generic about this. So there's a question. So a network of elements that just transfer a signal from whatever element is coupling to my readout. And the readout is just some device measuring the signal, generically an amplifier or a photon counter. I will be talking about amplifiers which are subject to the standard quantum limit. And the idea is that you want to optimize each block and simultaneously optimize interactions between the blocks. So let's start with the signal source. So as I said, you've got three main circuit elements, resistors, inductors, capacitors. And you can sort of break down into two regimes. You've got the regime that DM radio is in, where your experiment is naturally sub-Compton wavelength. We're not building 60 kilometer magnet bores to look for 5 kilohertz axions. And in this case, it's useful to think about the dark matter as a quasi-static AC current density. So this is like the stereoactive basis for the hidden photon. And in this case, the dominant effect is a magnetic field, just given by Biot Savar. So naturally, you will couple the magnetic fields with inductors, and you induce a voltage across your inductor via Faraday's law. Now say we are going to higher masses where the Compton wavelength of the experiment is comparable to the experiment size. So this describes an experiment like ADMX that's naturally in a cavity limit. In this case, the magnetic and electric field effects are comparable. So inductive and capacitive couplings yield comparable voltage excitations. But as we'll see, you actually get analogous interactions across the blocks, across those three blocks of the circuit model that I showed you. So for right now, we can just talk about inductive coupling. And at this point, you might say, hey, wait, Saptarshi, you mentioned this thing about resistive coupling. Why don't we do that? And this might be a fairly interesting question because, well, when you consider what a resistive coupling is, it's basically say I have a sheet conductor and I have some electric field incident on it and it's driving currents and dissipating power in my resistive sheet. And this in particular is interesting when you consider, well, let's just take vacuum electromagnetic waves. When just regular solutions to Maxwell's equations, when I take a sheet conductor and optimize its resistance, I can couple 50% of the power across all frequencies from that incoming wave. And well, coupling 50% of the dark matter power sounds really nice. If that was the case, we would be able to make incredibly strong limits on the dark matter or, well, have a really nice renewable energy source. But that doesn't actually work. And so this is something that we discuss in section 2 of our paper, where we basically say, OK, take my resistive sheet and now put another perfectly conducting sheet half Compton wavelength away. Now you have a resonant cavity. And you can just calculate it and say, the half-wave resonant cavity is better than this broadband resistive sheet that I've discussed.
When you compare the power at the same wavelength, right?
Yes.
The resonant wavelength.
Yes. So there's you get a factor of the quality factor at the resonant wavelength, and then you have to consider your scan.
Yeah.
But even after you consider your scan, you find that you win in search time by like the square root of the quality factor.
Yeah.
Because the signal noise.
Because the fundamental noise is lower by the square root. It's improved.
The power coupled is, and so the power coupled goes as Q, but then you lose
in time. The noise
is
like square root of Q, though.
The noise is just KT, or the noise power per unit bandwidth is just KT. You can set the noise powers to be the same in an apples-to-apples comparison, but the signal power coupled is not
yes,
the same.
Yes, the produced in the measured power output.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
I think we're on the same page.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And well, what's happening and what sort of makes this so hard is you have visible the power absorption in your resistive sheet, just this broadband absorber, is being limited by the radiation of visible photons. Basically, the dark matter is able to act as a stiff field in this case, precisely because all the visible photons that you're radiating are acting as a drag on those electrons. But this question, this begs the question: okay, we can't use the sorts of technique, power coupling techniques that we use with regular vacuum electromagnetic waves. So, what does it take to couple maximal power from a dark matter wave? Because that's sort of the detector we'd want to use. And this is, in fact, what we call, as experimentalists, the concept of impedance matching. What does it take to couple maximal power from an electromagnetic source? There's some about this in sections 2 and 3 of our archive paper, but I actually have a lot more to say about this. There will be another paper coming out, and it sort of tells us, from a circuit model perspective, okay, why is detecting dark matter so hard? That gives us our first guy. We've got inductive coupling to the dark matter signal. Anytime you build an inductor, there's naturally some loss, some resistance in that inductor, and that's going to create thermal noise.
Sorry, how much does this depend on the way this also depends on the experiment that you do. You could couple, is it always inductive? Are you supposed to think about the dark matter as a constant flux that goes?
You're thinking about the dark matter as a stiff flux source.
Okay.
Yeah. In the quasi
stiff. Always the case.
That it's
for
stiff.
For the that you're talking about, for coupling with a squid, having a pickup loop, that's always the case. What about other cases?
For either the dark photon axion coupling or dark photon, you always represent as a stiff current source.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then in the limit where your experiment is small compared to quantum wavelength.
I understand that. I'm asking, is that how specific is this statement to this? I mean, I think this is only specific to this type of experiments, right? You could have like NMR experiments.
These couplings, it's always a stiff current source.
To these couplings, yes. Couplings, yes. This is what I mean. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's only this specific.
It's only this specific axion photon or axion or hidden or kinetic mixing dark photon coupling. I'll discuss some.
Because the question I'm asking, how do you decide what is the right proper stiff source for the dark matter for a general question? Because this is specific to this type of couplings.
There are things to say on that, but that's a different. That gets into different topics.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I've started filling in my circuit model down here. I've got the dark matter effective current density creating a flux, which threads my inductor and creates a voltage. And then I've also got some resistance that creates some thermal noise voltage. The matching network I will come back to, because this is where some of the very, very interesting parts happen. But to give you an idea in terms of the sorts of experiments that I previewed before, you could have a single pole LC resonator. So you're basically connecting your inductor to some capacitor, and that creates an LC oscillator, which is a good circuit model for DM radio or a cavity like ADMX. You could imagine just a broadband inductive coupling where your matching network is just an inductor, and that is abracadabra. Or you can start thinking crazier things, just like all sorts of combinations of inductors and capacitors. So what I want to get to now is the readout. As my title suggested, I am looking at constraints relative to the standard quantum limit on amplification. I'll be talking about phase insensitive amplifiers, which are subject to the standard quantum limit. So for that, let me first tell you what a phase insensitive amplifier is. So an electromagnetic signal I can think of as having cosine and sine components. And in a phase insensitive amplifier, both of those components, called quadratures, are amplified equally. So that your gain is actually independent of the phase of the input signal. Because you're measuring both quadratures, there's some Heisenberg uncertainty associated with the fact that those quadrature operators don't commute. And this is a fairly rich subject. I've included many of the seminal papers as well as some modern review material that you can look at. So the standard quantum limit, what is it? It's saying that you have one photon of noise added by your by the measurement. What does this photon mean? You could my signal source had some thermal noise that is just proportional to the Bose-Einstein occupation number. And what that one photon represents is the increase in the thermal occupation number that I would need such that the change in thermal noise equals the amplifier noise. So sort of just absorbing and accounting for that amplifier noise with a higher occupation of my circuit. The standard quantum limit, being one photon, there's many different mathematical conventions for accounting for it. In the one that I'll talk about, it has two components. The first component is, you can split it into two components that contribute equally. The first component is zero-point fluctuation noise. And what this is basically saying is, okay, vacuum, when I apply my quadrature measurement operators, the cosine and the sine, to vacuum, these measurements have non-zero variance, and that results in noise. So I've shown that in my amplifier input down here. The red blob that you see here, I'm saying, is a dark matter signal. That's why I am displaced from the origin of my quadrature plot, plus some thermal noise, which gives me the blobbiness of the signal. And then in blue here, I've shown the zero-point fluctuation noise that is added to it. Now say I amplify my signal. Because I am amplifying equally two quadratures that correspond to non-commuting operators, I get some noise from that. And I show that's another half photon, and I show it in brown here. Upon amplification, my noise blobs have gotten bigger, both for the thermal noise and the zero-point fluctuation noise. Well, we can go further than that, and this goes back to the topic of noise matching that Kent was talking about the last time he was here. An amplifier, that half photon can be broken down into two effective noise modes. One is imprecision noise, which is just independent of whatever input circuit that I put on there. And then there's back action noise, which, as it sounds like, depends on what it acts back on your circuit and therefore depends on what that circuit is. So to give you two concrete examples of this, let me talk about two different amplifiers, both of which are used in experimental axion and dark photon searches. The first, which I call the scattering mode amplifier here, is the idea is I have an incoming wave, and it's amplified, and you get this output wave that I call B out. There's two noise modes. The first one is an imprecision noise mode, which it's there regardless of what's on the input. It's just intrinsic to the amplifier, and that's C1N here. The second, the back action noise mode, is actually something that is injected from the input of the amplifier back to your input circuit. So this wave reflects off your input circuit, comes back, is amplified, and appears as additional noise on top of your imprecision noise mode. And for the a different kind of amplifier, like a squid, you can think of it somewhat differently, but the limits consequences are the same. Say I have some input current that is threading some flux into a loop, and this this amplifier amplifies the flux and gives some output voltage, which I call Vout. There's going to be imprecision noise just in the intrinsic output voltage fluctuations. This is usually what we are talking about when we say squid noise, but there is a second component, which is the back action, which takes the form of circulating noise currents around my loop. These noise currents couple back as a voltage to my input circuit. It's So if I had an LC oscillator on here, that voltage signal, it would be rung up, and then you would have a resonantly enhanced current that comes back and appears as more noise on the output. So the concept of noise matching is the following. Say I couple too weakly to my squid. Then while I take a huge hit from my imprecision noise, but if I couple too strongly, what's happening is the voltage that's coupled back via the back action noise keeps on increasing, and eventually you get to the point where the back action noise is dominant. So what you end up having to do is you have to, in building practical amplifiers, is balancing the two so that you minimize your total noise. And that's, in fact, exactly what noise matching is. And we introduced this term called noise impedance, and that is just the impedance properties of the input circuit when you are noise matched. And achieving the standard quantum limit doesn't just mean that your amplifier has nice noise properties on its own, you also need to noise match to the amplifier. And this is where we'll see a significant limitation comes from. I've included my quantum limited amplifier down here because that's the best sort of amplifier we can use. So now we come to the matching network. So we have to ask ourselves, how do we optimize this? Well, first we have to decide what we are searching for. We need to create some value function that we can use to optimize our matching network. The value function generically needs to reflect two things. First, we want to be able to say, OK, searches that give high signal-to-noise ratio are good. A second thing, perhaps more subtle, is we need to decide what we're searching for. And therefore, we need a language of priors. Is there a favored mass or coupling range? Maybe we got lucky enough to find a candidate signal. Each of these things is going to affect how we search for, how we design our search for the dark matter. So the value function, as I discuss in the paper, is the expectation value of the SNR squared. This S that you see here is just a scattering matrix and just describes how signals are transferred between the signal source, the inductor and resistor, to the amplifier and back and forth.
So S of nu is basically the experiment, right?
It's the experiment. The expectation is evaluated with respect to the user-defined prior probabilities on mass, coupling. Go ahead.
Are you assuming anything about linear response yet? No.
Yes, we will assume linear response.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll get to that point in a moment. The search that we're most interested in is the thing that we call the log uniform search, which is basically saying we have no uninformative priors, and there's no likely information about the dark matter. It is uniformly likely to be anywhere in log space. And intuitively, what you want now is you want as much sensitivity as over as wide a band as possible. So if you could get resonant enhancement over an enormous band with some matching network, that would be what you want. In other words, you want to optimize integrated sensitivity.
For the axiom case, do you tie the mass to the strength of the coupling, or you just float them?
I'm floating them. So I'm talking axion-like particles in general with this for the purposes of this talk. So what I do is I choose some search band that I'm interested in. With any practical experiment, I obviously do not have an amplifier that can amplify an infinite band of frequencies, so I naturally cut it off somewhere anyways. And I'll call these frequencies nu L and nu H. And our figure of merit is what I call integrated sensitivity. This S21 is just the transmission from my signal source into my amplifier. And to sort of explain where all of these parts come from, this top fraction, this numerator represents sort of how much of my dark matter signal power is being transmitted through to my readout. This bottom represents the noise. So first I have some transmitted thermal noise, and N is the thermal occupation number of the signal source here. And then this plus one, it represents the one photon of measurement noise from the standard quantum limit. And so, yeah, you can see the signal to noise ratio aspect right here. And the fact that we're looking for integrated sensitivity instead of sensitivity at peak response is quite important in how we understand resonance searches. So over here, I have plotted the Lorentzian line shape of my resonator. Now, because the dark matter voltage and the thermal noise voltage come from the same place, they are filtered by the same Lorentzian response. So while my resonator, while my dark matter signal rolls off, my thermal noise also rolls off. And as long as I'm above the amplifier noise floor, my signal to noise stays the same. So I get the same sensitivity here as I do down here. And so this is why we can get substantial sensitivity outside of the resonator bandwidth. And this actually allows for an enormous scan rate enhancement in DM radio, which I will discuss. A second thing that it shows you is, well, when I talked about quantum limited amplifiers, it would have been natural to say, OK, that's overkill. I have kT of thermal noise power, but I have HF, which is much lower, of quantum noise power. That seems like overkill. But this is precisely the reason why it's not. We want our amplifier noise floor to be as low as possible to maximize the integrated sensitivity. So a very unique aspect of dark matter searches. In fact, I can't quite think of another place where quantum limited amplifiers are useful.
Well, I'm not sure if it's quantum limited, but for example, bar detectors from the 70s, they used exactly this to expand their bandwidth. So this is something that's well known in several.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe ADMX people didn't know this.
Yeah.
But I know of several people that I've talked to in the last at least 10 years that know this fact.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, and this is from 40 years ago.
Yeah. Reinventing the wheel.
Longer than that.
Yeah. These are ideas that our group has used in other places. So it's really useful for like the energy resolution of the calorimeters. But yeah, we had never thought about applying it to dark matter searches, and it's very useful.
But I'm telling you, it's a great example, because you can think of a gravitational wave signal as a, I mean, in this case, they were looking for more of a mass, but it was how you couple to it and how you increase the bandwidth, for example, for bar detectors. Even though their Q is 10 to the 7, the bandwidth is 10%.
Oh,
wow. Exactly for that reason.
Huh.
So
I'll have to look into this. So let's get back to our question of how large this integrated sensitivity, which I've parameterized by this function back here, how large can this possibly be? And the constraints provided by the following. On one side of my, on my signal source side, I have an inductor and a resistor. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to impedance match, basically, maximize the integrated sensitivity with a quantum limited amplifier. But a quantum limited amplifier has a real noise impedance. What that means is that to minimize the noise, to get that one photon of added noise, it wants to see a real impedance. It doesn't want to see the LR, which is naturally a complex impedance. So what you find then is you can, well, look at some very old electrical engineering textbooks that have now become sort of cornerstones on this thing called the Bode-Fano criterion. And what it says is, OK, let's assume that our matching network, so our detector is linear and it's passive. So this, Amina, is where we were talking about the assumption of a linear detector. And the passive, I'm basically saying that there are no external energy sources that are pumping energy back in. So this, an example of an active detector would be, say, if I took energy from the output of my amplifier and fed it back into my inductor in some manner. And say that it's also reciprocal, so that the S matrix is symmetric.
How would that affect?
I actually don't know what I these are just the assumptions that go into Bode-Fano.
Yeah.
Over the last 60 years, people have done many generalizations of Bode-Fano to non-reciprocal circuits and even active circuits.
Yeah.
I have not analyzed what the bounds are from that. I know that they exist. I just don't know how to apply them yet. Yeah. But a linear passive and reciprocal basically covers most of the things that you would think of making with resistors, inductors, and capacitors.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, yeah. So
if what how things change if you relax any of these.
Yeah.
I mean, the linear is clear that then it becomes more complicated. Then
yes.
All you have to do is consider the full response of the system. But mm-hmm. you know, with active, I don't have any intuition for the other stuff.
Yeah, the active, it's going to be, I think, quite a different bound. Reciprocity, it's not clear to me why that matters. It's not clear to me that being non-reciprocal will give a much better bound. But what we find in the end is we get a Bode-Fano limit on integrated sensitivity, and the optimal single pole resonator is 75% of that fundamental limit. So when it comes to searches like ADMX, Haystack, when you're thinking about how can I get the largest integrated sensitivity, you actually can't do that much better. Only 25%, and that corresponds to 25% scan rate enhancement. And actually, to get that 25%, you have to do some very complicated things that would pretty much more than compensate for that 25% that you lose.
So that's relative to the log uniform prior.
Yeah, flat priors, essentially. Now, the story changes if, say, I have a candidate signal. But
what happens if the question that Mark asked, what if you were to change the coupling along with the mass? Have you tried to see how that?
I don't quite understand the question.
No, the question that Mark is if you do it with something specific for the QCD action, for
example,
if you change the mass, the coupling strength changes.
Okay.
So the principle for heavier masses. I don't know how it would go.
What you could try is optimize detection probability across some mass range, yeah. And then that would be a different figure of merit, but it would have similar behavior.
Yeah.
I would imagine so.
And we did experiment around with different priors, and we couldn't get this this ratio of 75% to change very much, perhaps isn't.
Unless it's less than order one.
Yeah, if it's less than order one, if I have a candidate signal, what I'm talking about is very different. Yeah.
You're so ridiculous, and then you just.
Exactly. Yeah, you get.
That's a dream scenario.
Yeah, that's a dream scenario. Oh, and also, like, if there are false signals that are hard to get rid of, that's another place where you might think about it. I bolded this word optimal because there's a point to be made here about, again, noise matching and the balance between imprecision and back action. What we would naturally do is we would think, okay, I want to minimize the noise on resonance because I'm usually only interested in the on-resonance signal. But here I'm interested in integrated sensitivity, so let's see how things change. So in the noise match case, what's happening is that the imprecision and the back action noise are the same on resonance. And this gives you some sensitivity bandwidth, basically, where the imprecision noise accounts for half of the total noise power. Now say I increase my coupling to the quantum limited amplifier. My back action noise becomes much, much larger, which I've shown in red here. But my imprecision noise has dropped. So I get much larger sensitivity bandwidth. And in the end, I haven't actually increased the total noise power all that much because my thermal noise is just dominant. And so what I see here, what the optimum ends up being is that you want the back action noise power to be 50% of the thermal noise power. And this gives you a very large sensitivity bandwidth. To put some numbers on that, I made some plots here and to show what the parametrics of this process are. So if I'm noise matched so that the imprecision and back action noise are the same on resonance, then I get roughly a sensitivity bandwidth that's a square root of the thermal occupation number in resonator bandwidth. If I increase my back action noise until I hit that sweet spot of half my thermal noise power, now my sensitivity bandwidth goes linearly in my thermal occupation. And naturally in DM radio, we are in this regime where our thermal occupation is high. So this makes a substantial difference. So for a thermal occupation number of 50, which is what I've plotted here, this is about 4 megahertz at 10 millikelvin. The difference is sensitivity bandwidth of 14 versus 173 resonator bandwidths. And well, if I'm sensitive to an order of magnitude more frequencies, then my scan rate has increased by an order of magnitude. So this completes our optimal detector. A single pole resonator is fundamentally ideal under the assumption that I am a linear passive reciprocal detector, subject, of course, to the standard quantum limit.
So when you say you're increasing the back action as 50% of the thermal noise, is this simply a statement that I want my reactance and resistance of whatever the circuit is to not be so high that I'm damping out lower power signals? Is that one statement?
Can you say that one more time?
I'm just trying to, when you say I'm increasing my back action noise, this means that I'm, you know, decrease.
What I'm practically doing to my system, if I'm thinking about a squid, is I am increasing the mutual inductance between my input circuit and my squid, so that a particular current in my input coil gives a much larger flux. And because you have a much tighter coupling, having a much larger flux into the squid means a much larger noise flux out of the squid. Yeah. So practically, that's what that means.
That's where you might worry that the reciprocity assumptions are going to do things for you.
Maybe. Yeah, I'd have to think about that. So I want to end my talk about fundamental limits with this. And it's a comparison of a single pole resonator to a reactive broadband detector. And I want to do it for a couple of reasons. First, this is actually this is pretty much the comparison that got us thinking about all of these things when it comes to integrated sensitivity, Bode-Fano, priors, and because not too long ago, there was this paper in the literature basically asserting that a broadband detector can perform better than a resonator below 100 kilohertz. Now, what I've shown is that that has to be incorrect due to this Bode-Fano limit, but let's talk about it some more. If you want to see some details, it's in the last appendix of my paper, and everything that you'll see is there. So let me give you the intuition first. First, I mentioned Bode-Fano, and resonator is 75% of Bode-Fano. So if the Bode-Fano criterion pointed to the broadband being better, I would be nowhere close to 75%. The second thing is, well, we can go back to our circuit models. On the left here, I've shown an RLC resonator. And on the right, I have shown just a broadband search as was proposed in the Kahn paper. I have some pickup inductor that is picking up the flux of the dark matter, and that is being transferred to my squid. Now, near resonance, what's happening is in this circuit on the left, my thermal noise is rung up, and it's naturally above the amplifier noise. My amplifier noise is not degrading my measurement. In the broadband search, I have no resonant enhancement of the thermal noise. I have a pole structure, an LR pole, that basically just filters off my thermal noise after some very low frequency. And then my thermal noise is degraded by my amplifier. So naturally, a resonator has better signal-to-noise ratio near resonance. Now, above resonance, and we see why we need to consider integrated sensitivity. We can't ignore the information that our resonator gives at those very high frequencies. Specifically, the capacitor will short out, and now I basically have identical searches that give the same sensitivity. So what I can conclude is that, well, if I wanted to beat a broadband search, all I would do is I would put a resonator on my lowest search frequency, and that is better. So what you would conclude is that as long as you can practically construct an electromagnetic resonator, a one-pole resonator is going to be better than a broadband search. And as far as practical construction goes, this is true down until about 100 hertz. When you go below 100 hertz, the parasitics in your circuit become very difficult to manage because your elements become so large. You're talking about very large solenoids and very large capacitors. So We've constructed all this language for doing apples-to-apples searches, so let's do one. Apples to apples comparison, so let's do one. So let's assume that these detectors have the same volume, the same loss, so Q of 10 to the 6, detector temperature of 10 millikelvin. Let's say that we've optimized our amplifier at the standard quantum limit. With the resonant detector, you need to scan, whereas the broadband, you don't. So we're going to assume an equal time per e-folding. And we're also going to assume the same fixed search range. So what this means is that, so we're going to assume a lowest possible search frequency of 1 kilohertz. I mentioned 100 hertz as being the lowest bound where you can practically construct. Basically, in that range, the mathematical approximations that we use to develop the resonator optimization break down, but the conclusions still hold. And then at 100 megahertz, I'll set that to be the highest possible search frequency. Parasitics in your squid amplifiers usually make broadband amplification very challenging. And this is why ADMX, for example, uses resonant squid structures in their searches. So what I find, what I do is I do a wideband scan and a low frequency scan. That's what I've shown here. I've assumed, again, an equal time per decade. And what I show here is basically the minimum coupling, the ratio of minimal couplings that you are sensitive to in a resonant versus a broadband search. And a value less than one, which it is always, it means that the resonant search is gives a stronger limit. I've plotted, again, two scans. One is the log uniform wide scan from 10 kilohertz to 100 megahertz. And when I look at this, I am doing an order of magnitude better in coupling, or four orders of magnitude better in scan rate at 100 megahertz. And then as I come down, the it gets much closer. And I cut off at 10 kilohertz here. But if one were to just say extrapolate and go to, let's say go to 6 kilohertz, it would look that my resonator is worse, because that line's going to cross zero. And what's happened here is, well, no, my resonant search is not worse. What we've shown with this fixed resonator example is that it can't be. What's happened is my priors are now affecting my sensitivity. If I wanted to look, say, at 6 kilohertz or below, I would choose my priors to look 6 kilohertz or below. And for that, I have shown this red line, which is a low frequency resonant scan from 1 to 10 kilohertz. Same sort of apples to apples assumptions about integration time. And what we see is it's again less than one. This corresponds to roughly a factor of 5 in scan time.
Sorry, what's special about 10 kilohertz here?
10 kilohertz is, I've just cut that off as my wide scan, as well as to show that show the dangers of extrapolating below 10 kilohertz, because I've chosen my priors only to look in this search range.
It's the prior choice.
Yeah, it's the priors. OK, so let me summarize. So circuit models, I hope you have found, as I have, are very informative in setting these, in understanding and optimizing our dark matter detectors. We discussed why inductive coupling is optimal, specifically for the sub-Compton wavelength limit, and it's comparable to capacitive coupling in the Compton wavelength limit. The figure of merit for a receiver in a wideband search is integrated sensitivity instead of sensitivity at peak response. And that's why quantum limited amplifiers are desirable. And then the Bode-Fano criterion sets a limit on how well you can do with integrated sensitivity and shows that single pole resonators are fundamentally near ideal. And then I also concluded with talking about how a resonant detector beats a broadband detector under any prior as a way to sort of summarize all of these ideas. Yes?
So on the resonant versus broadband comparison,
yeah.
If we change the Q value,
yes.
So how does the broadband coupling sensitivity scale with the assumed, but it's not really Q in that case, but losses?
The assumed losses. So up here, it's going to go as the coupling ratio is going to go as Q to the 1/4. So what's causing my approximations to break down, this is a good time to discuss it, is down here, the resonator sensitivity bandwidth gets so large that it's comparable to the resonant frequency itself. and the natural Lorentzian approximations that you would make break down. Now, if my
you're not adapting the scanning step between those frequencies. So the scanning step in log is fixed to be 10 kilohertz, basically?
It's an equal time per e-folding, and while I can choose how I distribute my time because there are many time allocation strategies that will give me approximately the same sensitivity. So, I mean, if I choose to, say, have six steps within a resonant bandwidth, and I can compare that to, say, taking 12 steps in a resonant bandwidth and spending half the time at each. And well, when I look at my sensitivity, they give the same answer. But yeah, it's equal time per e-folding, if that answers your question.
So, presumably you need a Q of sort of tens of thousands in order to make the resonant one significantly better than doing a semi-broadband.
So fundamentally, this gets much closer to one when you're around a thousand. That said, there's a number of practical aspects that make a resonant search favorable. Specifically having to do with the fact that you are only looking at one face, and you can an inevitability with an electromagnetic search is that you all have pickup. And it's much easier to manage pickup over a bandwidth that is this big versus a bandwidth that is this big.
I assume it's still helpful to have a narrow band, but as you're scanning, you'll have to manage it here, and then you have to manage it here, and then you have to.
Yeah.
Is it easy to do that?
So some of your it depends on your system, but you can, for example, have tunable filters at room temperature that you just tune with your resonant filter, and those obviously don't have the same requirements as the resonant search that you might make. So with that, let me switch gears and talk about DM radio, which is a resonant search for axion and hidden photon dark matter that I work on. Here's the team. Here's our logo. I have more stickers of our logo in case you all want stickers. They're over there.
What range of axion mass and coupling?
So I'll talk about the couplings in a second. I'm 100 hertz to 300 megahertz. So that's
minus 13 EV to about
micro EV.
Yeah, 10 minus 12.
How am I doing on time, by the way?
You have.
Yeah, well, just keep going.
Just 10 minutes.
Okay, so I want to talk about how we go from fundamental limits to practical searches. Well, we know that inductive coupling is optimal, so we need to design some sort of inductive pickup. We want to build a single pole resonator, low noise amplifier, preferably quantum limited. And then two things that I didn't talk about is, well, you want low thermal noise, so you want to conduct your experiment cryogenically. And then you want a very high resonator Q, so you want to use superconducting components and low loss dielectrics. For time, I won't go too much through how we pick it up, but yeah, it's we use basically a superconducting inductor made out of a solid niobium sheath that is located inside a superconducting shield. And this basically, the flux lines flow through the bulk of my sheath. This creates screening currents, and then we resonantly enhance our signal. So what this means is that for the hidden photons, since the field lines are going circumferentially, I design a toroidal inductor, and I connect it to a tunable capacitor. And by tuning the capacitance, say by sliding dielectric in and out, I change the frequency. And then I connect this setup to a squid amplifier, a DC squid amplifier. For axions, our magnet is actually a toroidal magnet. That's located inside this sheath that you see here that creates So the axion effective current goes in the same direction as my DC magnetic field, and that creates, right-hand rule, just magnetic field lines going up and down, so I do with solenoid. And so our pilot is going to be focused on hidden photons. We're funded through the slack LDRD process. We're going to start at 4 Kelvin in a liquid helium dip probe, where you see here. And then, so you can see, we're going to do 100 kilohertz to 10 megahertz first, and over a 2 to 3 month scan time. Here's some CAD drawings, just so you can see things. So I have a niobium slitted sheath. Where we connect our squid is across this slit here.
What are the screws you were talking about?
I'll show you.
Just ask another sort of...
Yeah.
So I don't usually think about these type of things, but so it's a very light, it's a very light hidden photon, but the effect's coming from the kinetic mixing.
Yes.
So if I use a dimensionless parameter in front of the two Fs.
Yeah.
How small is that?
Our reach? Yeah, I'll show you our reach in a moment. So we connect our squid across here. Our resonant inductor is wound around the sheath. And then right here you see a hexagonal parallel plate capacitor. These are all made out of niobium. We'll have some movable sapphire dielectrics that change the resonant frequency. And yes, this is a 750 milliliter detection volume. So this sheath here is about 7.5 centimeters in diameter and 19 centimeters tall. And there's some more pictures. There's a picture of our squid. One of the things about building an experiment is that you want to start small so you can start to understand all of your problems. So instead of doing a tunable resonator as our engineering testbed for all of these ideas, we constructed a fixed resonator that is just a niobium titanium coil, which you see here, wrapped around some Teflon. And that is connected to a sapphire wafer that's been metallized on both sides with niobium. So again, this is an LC. We have some transformer coils that loop to our squid, which isn't shown here. It's in its own separate shielded annex. And one of the critical things about experiments is calibration data analysis. We have two ways to do that. We've designed basically an inductive injection coil to mimic so like a fake hidden photon signal. And with this system, we want to get as high Q as possible, preferably showing Qs of a million, understand materials properties, things like thermal contraction that can break an experiment, understand what sorts of screws that we can use. And yeah, the screws that I was talking about are here, 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 and here. You can't see them in our picture, but they're in our inductor coil. So here's some of our first resonator data. We've got a Q of 13,000. Our sensitivity bandwidth is about a factor of 30 above our resonant bandwidth, which we can tell because we can resolve our thermal noise above the squid noise. So our thermal noise is greater than our amplifier noise. And we are continuously optimizing our DC squids to do this. Being at 4 Kelvin, we're not going to be able to get quantum limited, but this is good practice for us, especially because it means that our pilot will be able to do more science. So right now our Q is likely limited by loss in support structure. An experiment is not just an L and a C, you need mechanical supports. So right now we have some brass screws outside our inductor coil, and we think we're inducing eddy current loss in those, and that will be replaced with niobium screws very soon. And we've got several hours of integration on this peak so that we can test calibration analysis protocols. So that's our plan. Continue increasing Q factor, do some squid optimization. The pilot detector is now fabricated, all major parts. So niobium, sapphire, Teflon, all those major parts that we need are now made. There's now going to be some work on our tuning system. From going to fixed resonator to the pilot, one of the big tasks is we need to be able to tune our resonator. We're learning how to do that now. Pilot science scans probably begin later this year, And courtesy of Heising-Simons, we have a dilution refrigerator on order. We're going to be scaling up first to 30 liters and then to 1,000 liters at 10 millikelvin.
Sorry, what's the volume cost?
How much do they cost?
$400,000 plus some other few things. Yeah. So after we get our refrigerator, did you have more?
What's the volume of the pilot?
Of the pilot, 750 milliliters. Yeah. So we're not planning any magnets for this smaller pilot, but after we get our dilution refrigerator, that'll be a big topic, magnet R&D. And then what we're starting now is ways to push our amplifiers toward the quantum limit using some of these microwave squids that we've re-optimized microwave squids, similar to what's used in, will be used in next generation CMB experiments. So finally, science reach plots, which I'm sure people want to see. This is for the Axion. So the phase one detector is 30 liters. We can get down about here with different levels of magnetic field. I'm assuming Qs of a million and 30 days per E-folding of integration. Phase two, we're going much larger to 1,000 liters. And what I wanted to show here is the difference between considering only your resonator bandwidth information and having a fully optimized quantum limited scan near the Bode-Fano optimal. This right here is about 1.25 to 1.5 orders of magnitude in coupling, or 5 to 6 orders of magnitude in scan time. So it's a substantial effect. And then this is the similar plot for hidden photons. This is our pilot detector. This line here was made with only information in our resonator bandwidth. We don't quite know how well we'll be able to do with the sensitivity bandwidth, but we know from our first demonstrator that we should be able to do fairly better. So we're evaluating and optimizing now.
So for the whole area taken out, how long is scan time, is that assuming?
From 100 kilohertz to 10 megahertz. That's 30 days per E-folding, so that's, 30 days per decade. So that's 2 to 3 months, yeah.
And the big one is how much, a year?
So that's, what is that? That's six decades, half a year, yeah.
If I go down all the way to a PeV, I want to think about what the Compton wavelength for that mass is. How big is that? It's a huge thing.
It's 100 kilometers.
So it's macroscopic.
Yeah.
So as my very last topic, I wanted to say, okay, we've set these fundamental limits. We use them to talk about DM radio optimization. Now let's talk about what the future holds and maybe how we might get around them. What I've held fixed here is, okay, I've assumed that there's some inductor quality and some inductor volume that I can have. We can always talk about making bigger, higher quality receivers. One thing that we talk about is why going above Qs of a million beyond the virial bandwidth is a good thing to do. We also know that this is very hard to do. So what are the other things that we can work with? There's generically two categories. We can talk about evading the Bode-Fano constraint. So what this might be is some nonlinear or active matching circuit. Another thing that I didn't talk about is I intrinsically assume that there's only one element coupling to the dark matter in my circuit. I assume that there's one inductor or one capacitor. You can also say, what if I have elements all over my circuit that are coupling to the dark matter? This is what we call a multi-port circuit. One thing I'd like to add is that for active and matching and multi-port circuits, there actually are more generalized Bode-Fano bounds, and that's work that we're doing to understand what those bounds imply. From a practical perspective, once you introduce these things, calibration and stability, especially with active matching networks, becomes a challenge. You also have to start worrying about interactions between receiver elements. What I want to advertise and advocate here is, well, you can also talk about evading the standard quantum limit on amplification, and there are many, many ways to do that. And a natural step is to start with, have such beyond standard quantum limit technologies integrated with experiments that are already underway. And this is actually something that's being done. Haystack at Yale is integrating a squeeze states receiver. ADMX is talking about photon counting. And DM Radio, we are starting R&D on back action evasion. So if we can evade the standard quantum limit or evade Bode-Fano, we can access this parameter space. And with that, I'll end on my summary slide and take more questions.
Thank you.
So if you go down to, if you go to those slides, I mean, so even if you...
Which slide?
Just the one beforehand. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we, say, do photon counting, which is, yes, in some sense the best you can do, how far does that line go down?
Oh, so in this regime, photon counting actually doesn't help you because you still got KT of noise power. This is classical.
Oh, anyway.
Yeah. Oh.
If you reduce...
Because the photon is...
Zero temperature.
Yeah.
Oh, at zero temperature?
I think that's right.
So if your temperature is still this high, then the quantum enhanced amplifier won't help you.
Actually, back action evading will. So I can talk more about this offline. You remember how I said, okay, the optimal quantum limited readout is back action dominated. Well, if I get rid of my back action or reduce my back action naturally somehow, which is what a back action evading measurement does, then my sensitivity, my integrated sensitivity gets better. We think our goal is to sort of hit one or two orders of magnitude in scan rate improvement.
But that's interesting. So there are certain circumstances where a certain type of quantum detector can be better than a photon counter.
Effectively.
Yeah. Even with zero temperature.
Zero temperature is a different deal. And we're not going to get much colder than 10 millikelvin, maybe 5 millikelvin.
I mean, if we put the zero temperature photon counter line there, where would that be?
I don't know. At zero temperature, I mean, you don't have any thermal shot noise anymore.
Yeah, there is always thermal shot noise. What? I mean, even
at zero temperature?
So there's always noise from thermal. Even if you're at zero temperature, the point is that if you look at the Kubo formula for the fluctuation dissipation theorem, okay, you can apply it to all temperatures.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. The naive square root of T thing does not work. You have a contingent. So there's basically...
Oh, okay, yes.
This is the same.
The photon counter doesn't see any of that noise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't see that noise. It doesn't see H bar omega.
It will, though. There's still that noise there at zero temperature. Yes, any type of detector you use that work the way you describe will
see... If I'm doing quadrature measurements, yes, then I'll see H bar omega.
Right.
Yes. But if I'm doing, say, pure amplitude measurements, if I'm not measuring quadrature operators, then I get around that. Yeah, exactly. Which is, yeah, the point that I was trying to make.
I think it's about it's about 10 to the minus 18 flat there-ish, something like that. Maybe a bit lower for these volumes.
Well, you have to decouple, right? There must be the coupling.
You don't...
Because of the mass, I mean, the coupling of the...
You decouple when it comes to the order of the volume, so it'll start going up again at
So there's another order of magnitude.
It'd be interesting to plot that and see how far you can actually go down.
Yeah.
That's not too hard to do.
Do you know what ADMX is? So you said ADMX is thinking about doing photon counting?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more?
They're talking about photon counting with superconducting qubits.
Okay.
They've got a group of people there at a Fermilab. Aaron Chu, along with Dave Schuster at University of Chicago. Those are the main guys working on this.
And this is for higher frequencies.
Yeah, this is at higher frequencies where your thermal occupation is essentially zero.
Yeah.
Other questions?